Before I get started this morning, I just wanted to let you know, for those of you who didn't know, Dave Bergner passed away this past week. And, you know, his funeral was great, great service. Russ did a fantastic job. It was standing room only. He touched a lot of people's lives. So if you could just be praying for the family, I mean, Dave is where he needs to be. You know, he's finished the race, he's fought the good fight, and he's home. But if you could just be praying for the family, for comfort, you know, just keep them in your thoughts and prayers this week. This morning we're going to be in 1 Peter 3:15. Recently, the Pew Research Center released the results of a major study. It was all about the religious beliefs of Americans. And they discovered that the fastest growing religious segment of Americans is not Christians. We've actually been on a steady decline for the last 50 years now. It's also, surprisingly, not Islam. The fastest growing group is the nuns. Not the Catholic nuns, the N-O-N-E-S nuns. Well, what's going on? Oh, man. So that's the name that they give to the people who say that they're either atheists, they're agnostic, or they just don't have any particular belief at all. Listen to this. Back in 2007, about 16% of Americans fit that category of the nuns. 8 years later, in 2015, it was at 23%. Today, that number has grown to 28%. While 63% of Americans still claim to be Christians, according to Lifeway Research, only 27% of them attend church regularly. So that means that the nuns are outgrowing the faithful, weekly church-attending Christians. So it's safe to say that the spiritual climate in our country is changing rapidly. And there are all kinds of implications of that. A good implication in days to come is that what we're going to see is that fewer and fewer people are going to call themselves Christians simply because they were born into a Christian family or because of cultural pressure or because they feel like it's the American thing to do. We are quickly becoming a post-Christian culture, just like what happened in Europe years ago. And I know you're saying, why is that a good thing, Dave? Because in the days to come, if you choose to align yourself with Jesus and embrace the mission of Jesus, it's actually going to mean something. Being a Christian is going to become more and more countercultural, very much like it was in the first few centuries when this movement was brand new. So in this changing culture, if you call yourself a Christian, people might look at you a little funny. Maybe they already do. And some of you, they'll say, well, you're a Christian? You go to that church? Why? And my question for you this morning, what will you tell them? What do you tell them? How would you answer that question right now? 1 Peter 3:15 says, "But in your hearts, revere Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. But do this with gentleness and respect." That's pretty clear, right? People are going to ask, why do you believe this? If you have little kids, they're going to grow up and be teenagers. And they're going to ask, why do you believe this? Because all my teachers at school, all my friends at school, they say it's not real. And if you're an analytical person like me, you're going to have moments where you say, where you ask yourself, why do you believe this? And Peter basically says, it's a fair question, and you should be ready to answer it. So this morning, for whatever it's worth, I'd like to share with you 10 reasons why I'm a Christian. Everybody loves top 10s, right? So my goal this morning is to hopefully help you formulate your own top 10, to give you a tool to put in your toolkit to prepare you to give an answer when you're asked. All right, let's get into this. Number 10, longing. Longing. I believe that from childhood, every human being has this natural sense of that there's something more to life than just this. And every human has this longing to connect with whatever that something is. Even when I was young, I had this sense that I was missing something, that feeling where there's this void in your life, but you can't really put your finger on exactly what it is that's missing. And I've become convinced that it's placed in us by our Creator. Ecclesiastes 3:11, He has made everything beautiful in its time. He has also set eternity in the human heart, yet no one can fathom what God has done from beginning to end. God has set eternity in the human heart. So part of being created in God's image is having this longing and this transcendence, this longing for transcendence in eternity. It can't be fully satisfied in this life. Now, some people would just say, well, that's just a feeling. It's just because you long for something doesn't mean that it actually exists. That's just Freudian wish fulfillment. But I would challenge that. In his book, Mere Christianity, C.S. Lewis described it like this. Creatures are not born with desires unless satisfaction for those desires exist. A baby feels hunger. Well, there is such a thing as food. A duckling wants to swim. Well, there is such a thing as water. Men feel sexual desire. Well, there is such a thing as sex. If I find in myself a desire in which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. Mere Christianity is a great book, easily one of the best books I've ever read, and also a great tool for you to put in your toolkit to help you formulate your own top 10. But I think he makes a good point. It's certainly not enough to make me a Christian, but it points toward the likelihood that there's something more beyond this world. Number 9, creation. I distinctly remember back in 1986 waiting outside on our front porch to see Halley's Comet pass by. I remember Dad had this huge telescope. I mean, this thing was ginormous, and we didn't need it that night. But, you know, he would get it out every once in a while, and we would just look out at the solar systems and, you know, the planets and just look at everything in amazement and wonder. Lexi and I, before it got too cold, we were out on a hike at night in the woods, and it was a meteor shower that night. It was so cool because you'd just be walking down a path, and you'd just see them just constantly shooting. I love meteor showers. But whenever it's warm enough, whenever there's a meteor shower, we'll actually go out and lay on our back porch, just lay on the ground and just watch, you know, the stars shoot across the sky. They even have this app now that tells you where everything is at. So you can point your phone at the sky and it'll tell you where the International Space Station is or whatever, everything. Now, more and more scientific research is showing us how our world works. I mean, that's how astronomers can predict when there's going to be a meteor shower. And some people will say, well, look, now that we understand how things work, we don't need God to use God as an explanation. You know, so you've heard that, right? It's what's driving this new movement of the nuns. In other words, as science grows, our need for God decreases. But that's not valid reasoning. And here's why. Science can explain how something works, but it can never explain why it's there in the first place. Does that make sense? Science can explain the mechanism of things in our world, but it can't answer if there's an intelligent mind behind those things, or why they stir a sense of beauty or wonder in us. Psalm 19 says, "The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of His hands. Day after day they pour forth speech. Night after night they reveal knowledge." So for me, the natural world is another clue that points to the existence of God. Reason number 8, atheism. For me, it's just not an intellectually or morally satisfactory option for many reasons. First of all, I don't think it adequately accounts for the first two things I mentioned. You know, our inner longing for transcendence and the wonder of creation. I think atheists dismiss those things too easily. But I also have a problem with atheism because of where it leads. One of the things I appreciate about the book of Ecclesiastes is that Solomon kept trying to find satisfaction without God in the picture. That's his under the sun concept, right? And consistently, what did he find? He found that approach to be empty, like a vapor that you can't hold on to. And I would say that the great atheistic points of view have come to similar conclusions. Life is meaningless and absurd, and if you're a committed atheist, then you have to somehow bravely face that and invent your own meaning in a meaningless world. Wow. That's a lonely, sad existence. It genuinely makes me feel sorry for them. And I just think that's an overly pessimistic way to view reality. Number 7, justice. If you think back over the past several years, our culture has seen many instances where people have demanded justice. Throughout history, you typically got immediate justice. I remember my wife and I were just watching the show 1883. And I'll tell you what, back in those, that's basically, if you don't know what that is, it's like, do you guys remember the game Oregon Trail? They made a TV show about that. But I mean, it's immediate justice. You look at somebody sideways, you know, and it got taken care of right there. Somewhere along the way, though, the idea of justice just got completely convoluted. In more modern times, whether you agree with it or not, we here in America, we have the right to peacefully assembly, right? And in today's world, that's what people do to be heard. And here's my point. Whatever you might think about those causes, the thing that energizes people to join those causes is a deep belief that there's such a thing as right and there's such a thing as wrong. And so they raise their voice and they join in these protests because they feel passionately that something is wrong. And they long for it to be made right. They want the injustice to become justice. Like the Take Our Border Back convoy that right now is headed down across the southern United States in support of the United States Constitution being upheld. That people should come to our country legally. And supporting those efforts of the state of Texas is 25 other states, including the state of Ohio. They are all supporting the United States constitutional rights of not just Texas, but our entire country. Because at some point, if this continues, we will all be affected by the outcome if we're not already. There is a right way and there is a wrong way. So it begs the question, if there's no higher law given by some higher mind to base your morality on, how would we ever get a sense of justice and injustice? We wouldn't know the difference between right or wrong without God. The simplest way to put it is that for there to be good, there must be the opposite. For something to be good, there has to be a moral standard for that to be based upon. And the same goes for bad or evil. To me, our inner sense of right and wrong is evidence that there is an ultimate right or wrong, which is placed in us by our Creator. In Romans chapter 2, it's talking about people who aren't even aware of God's commandments. And here's what it says, Romans chapter 2, verse 15. They show that the requirements of the law are written on their hearts, their consciences also bearing witness, and their thoughts sometimes accusing them and at other times even defending them. So I believe that our inner sense of justice points to the existence of a just God. There's no way to neatly tie that one up into a bow for you this morning. That would take up a whole sermon or maybe even two. So we'll just kind of keep that in the back of our minds for maybe the future, a future message. Reason number 6, sin. I believe in sin. Remember the big Penn State child abuse scandal back in 2010? It was an assistant coach on the football team that was accused of abusing a young boy in the locker room, and nobody reported it. It was a huge mess. Shortly after that, David Brooks wrote an opinion column in the New York Times, and the title of his piece was, "Let's All Feel Superior." Let me read a few lines of it for you. "First came the atrocity. Then came the vanity. The atrocity is what Jerry Sandusky has been accused of doing at Penn State. The vanity is the outraged reaction of a zillion commentators over the past week, whose indignation is based on the assumption that if they had been in Joe Paterno's shoes or assistant coach Mike McCreary's shoes, they would have behaved better. Unfortunately, none of us can safely make that assumption. Over the course of history, during the Holocaust, the Rwandan genocide, or the street beatings that happen in American neighborhoods, the same pattern has emerged. Many people do not intervene. Very often they see, but they don't see. People are really good at self-deception. We inflate our own virtues and predict we will behave more nobly than we actually do." Now listen, this is where it gets brilliant. "In centuries past, people built moral systems that acknowledged this weakness. These systems emphasized our sinfulness. They reminded people of the evil within themselves. Life was seen as an inner struggle against the selfish forces inside. But we're not Puritans anymore, he says. We live in a society oriented around our inner wonderfulness. So when something atrocious happens, people look for some artificial outside force that must have caused this. People look for laws that can be changed so it never happens again. Commentators ruthlessly vilify all involved from the island of their own innocence. Everybody gets to proudly ask, how could they have let this happen? The proper question is, how can we ourselves overcome our natural tendency to evade and self-deceive? I think he's asking exactly the right question. How can we overcome our natural tendency to sin? Here's what I'm sure of. We do have that tendency, or at least I'll speak for myself. I have that tendency. And as I've matured, hopefully I've become more aware of my capacity to be selfish, of my capacity to be arrogant, and my capacity to be greedy. Sin is a real thing, and it causes personal misery. It causes relational breakdowns. On a global level, it causes war and terrorism. We're seeing that right now. And I believe the Christian faith, better than any other philosophy or system, takes sin seriously, and it deals with sin in a very direct way. All right, reason number 5, love. In my lifetime, I have seen more amazing and costly sacrificial acts of love done in the name of Christ than for any other reason. When natural disasters happen, Christian individuals and Christian organizations seem to rise up and pour themselves out to bring relief and help people rebuild their lives. A movie just recently came out last year. If you didn't go and watch it in theaters, I think it's out now on DVD and it's streaming, The Sound of Freedom. It was an amazing movie. Christians are leading the fight against modern-day sex slavery and trafficking. I have a niece that was kidnapped and taken to held in a dirty motel room down on the outskirts of the Everglades. She was hanging out with some bad people, and she ended up being taken. Unspeakable things were done to her. Life-altering things. Probably hours away from being shipped overseas, she somehow, some way, got a hold of one of her captor's cell phone and was able to get a hold of my oldest brother, her stepdad, and he was able to locate her and rescue her. Now, I only share that with you to tell you that sex trafficking is a real, real issue, and more people have been affected by it than you realize. And Christians are at the forefront of that fight. I remember in college, there was this terrible storm that came through, and there was this small town that just got flooded out completely, and there was a bunch of college kids from the college that got together, and we went over to help the town clean up and just provide what relief we could. I'm not saying that only Christians do that kind of stuff. I'm not saying that. I know atheists have, they do relief work, and there's Muslim relief organizations. But here's the thing, the drive to sacrificially love people is not on the peripheral of the Christian faith. It's not one of several elements of the Christian faith. It is the very essence of Christianity. The core of the Christian faith is a man who sacrificed his comfort and ultimately gave up his life for the good of others. And he calls us to follow in his footsteps. Jesus said in John 13, "Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. I have set you an example that you should do as I have done for you." It's very powerful. Reason number 4, Jesus. I've become convinced that Jesus is just absolutely in a class all by himself. So many issues that we take for granted were actually introduced to our culture by Jesus. Generosity, courage, love, respect, hope, peace. He's had a massive influence on the world. But in a more personal way, in my own personal spiritual search, the thing that's grabbed my attention more than anything on this list is Jesus. And maybe that seems obvious, but I think it needs to be said. Philip Yancey used this analogy. He had this huge unabridged dictionary and with tiny font. And so he got this huge magnifying glass out with a light bulb built into it. And he put it over and he said, when I focus the magnifying glass on a word, that word shows up crisp and clear in the center, while the edges grow progressively distorted. Life can be confusing at the best of times. And I'm kind of hard-headed. So it took me a majority of my life to learn this, but it was, about 6 years ago now where I finally relented and I made the decision that I was just completely surrendering to God, that I would follow whatever path Jesus laid out in front of me, no matter the cost, and he's led me here. And if I'm not going to sit here and tell you that it's been all rainbows and roses, but I've never been closer to Jesus than I am right now at this point in my life. And that's allowed me to lead many others to follow Christ as well. And what I've found personally is that all of those things that I was chasing never had the potential to give me fulfillment. The fulfillment that I have now following Jesus so closely. I've taken my life and I've magnified Jesus with it, and he's blessed me for it. And my goal is to teach others to do the same. All right, reason number three, the resurrection. Jesus was executed by the Roman government in a very public way. Lots of people saw him die. And then 3 days later, his followers were running around claiming that he's alive again, which is kind of a ridiculous claim. And all someone had to do to silence that claim was what? Produce the body. Let's go dig up the body of Jesus and prove once and for all that they're lying. No one could produce the body. You know why? It wasn't there. That's interesting. And there are so many other strands of evidence that support the resurrection. The fact that in the Gospels, the first eyewitnesses of the resurrection were women, which if this were a made-up story, they would have never written it that way, because in that culture, women weren't considered reliable witnesses. The fact that the early disciples were so changed after seeing Jesus alive, they were willing to go to their deaths in horrible ways rather than deny their faith in him. And that's not a bond, that's not something you do for someone that you followed around for 3 years. They must have seen something. They must have felt something. In fact, they were so changed and so emboldened that this movement, which never should have survived, wound up sweeping through the entire Roman Empire and becoming the dominant faith. Can you scientifically prove the resurrection? No. But I think the clues are very compelling. Number two, the cross. Everybody knows the cross is a symbol of the Christian faith. But for years, I didn't really understand how significant that was. I mean, I understood that's where Jesus died in our place to satisfy God's judgment against our sins. I got that part. But then I started to see more facets of it. You know, I saw that Jesus was willing to do that for me. He did that for me. Wow. Well, that must mean that God truly does love me. So when people feel worthless, the cross gives them value and dignity. I saw that my sin was so serious that someone actually needed to die for it. So the cross makes arrogant people deeply humble. I saw that Jesus died for all people equally, regardless of their race, regardless of whether they're a man or a woman. So the cross turns people into agents of reconciliation. I saw that God was satisfied with the death of Jesus in my place, and he forgave me of all the ways that I've offended him throughout my life, which makes me quick to forgive people who offend me. The cross takes bitter, wounded, self-pitying people and makes them forgiving people. I saw that Jesus didn't stay dead. He rose again on the third day, which gives me hope for the future. So the cross turns hopeless people into future-oriented, hopeful people. There's so much depth to the cross that I just never saw. The cross of Christ changes people in ways that are good for relationships and good for families and good for the world. And then the number one reason why I call myself a Christian calling. Beyond our logical reasons and any analytical thinking that we can do, I believe that ultimately you have to be drawn by the Spirit of God. John 6:44, Jesus said, "No one can come to me unless the Father who sent me draws them, and I will raise them up at the last day." At some point, we have to say yes to Him. But we don't initiate that process. Our yes is always a response to His call. I remember making the decision to go to a Christian college to be a minister, answering the call. I had a great college experience. Catherine and I kind of run this back and forth with each other a lot. You know, if I could go back to college, that's when I loved college. It was great. I spent most of my time in ministry while attending college at a wonderful church, Pleasant Valley Church of Christ in Foxport, Kentucky. Now, I ended up taking a different path after I graduated. I took a pretty long detour, like a 20-year detour. But on that detour, I was still able to impact the lives of many young men. Actually, one of them that I've kept in contact with texted me last week. And I worked with him, I think, in 2004, maybe 2006. He reached out to me last week. He texted me for some spiritual advice and some marriage advice, and to answer some questions about some scriptures. He's doing great, though. You know, him and his wife are raising their kids in the church. Last year, I also got a call from this one. He's not a kid anymore, but this young man I worked with, and he was the worst, top five easily, of the kids that I worked with. But I didn't treat him any different. He actually called me last year. As soon as I picked up the phone, he said, "Mr. Dave." Now, I can't tell you what we called it. It was his last name. But it's just the way we said it. But I knew it was him as soon as he called. And you know why he tracked me down? He tracked me down to say thank you for caring about him. He knew that that was much more than a job to me, that I genuinely cared for these boys and young men that the world had cast aside. I said, "You matter, and I care about you." And he just wanted to call me and say thank you, that I made a difference in his life. He's also doing really well now. He's got a wife and kids. Now, I might not have been the best example of what a Christian should be, but God still used me where I was and with who I was. I didn't have the relationship with him that I have now. He calls us all in different ways, doesn't he? To do different things for his kingdom. He's given us all talents and gifts to use. Are you using those gifts to influence this world for Christ? He's very creative in the way that he calls us all to himself. But the point is this. Christianity is not a set of beliefs or a philosophy that you can study and debate and argue about on the internet and decide if you're going to believe or not. That's religion. Christianity is about a living God who shows up in your life in unexpected ways, through the circumstances in your life and the people in your life. And he works on your mind and he shows you the beauty of the cross and the uniqueness of Jesus. And he calls you to himself. And I would just ask you to do one thing. If you sense the call of God, humble yourself and open your heart to him. I promise you that he has some amazing plans in store for you. If you are here today and you feel that God is calling you, maybe that call is to be baptized today. And we would love to have you come forward and give your life to Christ. Maybe that call is to place your membership here at First Church of Christ. I want to invite you to do that as well. Or maybe that call is to get involved in some aspect or avenue of our church, to serve the Lord with the gifts that he's given you. Again, we would love to have you serve here with us at First Church. Would you stand with me as we close in prayer? Dear Lord, we love you so much. Lord, the truth is I could, For time restraints, I had to keep it to 10. I could have a top 50 even, who knows. Lord, I'm sure we all could say the same. We're so thankful for the many different ways that you've reached this world and that we get to be a part of spreading the good news to this world, to be a light in the darkness, to lead people home. Lord, we're so thankful for the lives you've given us and the ways that you've blessed us and this church that we have to gather together each week to celebrate and worship you. Thank you so much, Lord. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.